Blog Talk Radio.
Nothing here. Okay. This is my country, but once is enough. Among the interesting birthdays today, we'll get into the long interview we did with Jack Phillips, the Dean of Broadcast Engineer Teachers and Technicians here in Northern California. His 50 years of experience and words of advice for people who, young people who are aspiring to be broadcasters or technicians, or what their future might be in the broadcasting industry, and also about bringing personal politics and preferences and sexual preferences and the like into the workplace. Among the birthdays today, one of the most notorious of all the Roman emperors, Caligula. That means little boot in Latin. And he was one of the biggest monsters of the Julian family. The Julian family is named after Julius Caesar and emperors who succeeded him, Tiberius, Nero, Augustus, Octavian. And he lived for about 4 years. He's the guy that made his horse a consul. And I believe nobody's been able to dispute this, but he may be the origin of the hate crime mania that we've seen. Sorry about that, but I can't help that outside noise. That's a motorcycle, but they're not coming for me. That we see in totalitarian countries and here in the United States and Canada. He tortured people and devised all kinds of tortures, and he said it's not enough to kill them quickly. They've got to suffer, make them suffer. And that's the whole idea about how we see the application of so-called hate crimes, that there are laws on the books. If somebody beats up an ethnic or somebody of a different sexual preference, there are laws. They're already there, and they have been enforced, they have been applied, and they're effective. But this whole business of so-called hate crime, which is an intellectual intimidation, may go back and have its origin with Caligula in the old Roman Empire. And he did some really horrible things. He was finally assassinated by the Praetorian Guard. Also today is the birthday of Marie Montessori. Those of you who have children going into school or have maybe have tried this method, she was an Italian woman born in 1870 And her idea of the Montessori method was to let children initiate things and to give them freedom of movement. I don't know if this is the best thing. Of course, we had Dr. Spock, and we had Generation of Vipers, the famous book by Philip Wiley. So I don't know if this is the best thing. It's been a long time since I dealt with bringing up kids. Among the other birthdays today is one of the most famous queens in Dutch history, Queen Wilhelmina. She was the queen during the Nazi invasion of Holland in 1940, and she fled to England with her daughter and family, later Juliana. Juliana was famous because she had some one of the rarest breeds of Afghan hounds, and there's a few pictures of them. I'll see if I can find it, since that is one of our interests, and we will run the videos that we did with the Russian Navy and how they greeted an Afghan. she was very famous, and she abdicated in 1948 in favor of her daughter, Juliana. And Juliana had four daughters, and these Dutch queens seemed to like German princes. They all married Germans. Bernhard was the consort. He was a German officer who married Juliana. And then one of Juliana's daughters married Klaus, this is Beatrix, who was supposedly in the Wehrmacht, and a lot of controversy, but that's Germany. And also today is the birthday of DuBose Hayward. He's the guy who wrote the script for the famous black opera, where the music was provided by George Gershwin, called Porgy and Bess. Also, the father of modern volleyball, when you slam that ball across the neck, think of his unusual name, A. Provost Idel, born in 1889, about the same time that baseball and basketball was also started. And here's one of the most interesting actors, Frederick Mark. Unfortunately, we don't have the audio clip ready, but many films that he starred in, and he was a ladies' man. He wasn't one of the gays in Hollywood, and used to go around patting women on the butt. He was in the early film with A Star is Born, and also one of the last films he did was 10 Days in May, about an attempted takeover of the United States by the military, and it starred Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas, and what's her name, Ava Gardner. And a great film, I highly recommend it, because it could happen. Let's hope it doesn't happen. Let's hope it never should happen or has to happen, because people are getting really tired of this growing anarchy around the country. We've had it here in California, in Northern California, with our transportation system. We have growing public corruption, and what has happened in other countries when people want to feel secure, and especially in a bad economy, when you have these anarchists who have nothing better to do but go around stirring up you-know-what for no reason, that people are getting tired of it, and they want to swing to the right, and they want police to come down hard, and some people even are talking of martial law. Let's hope that never has to happen in this country. It did happen in Canada in the early 70s when Pierre Laporte, a provincial minister, their provinces are equivalent to our states, he was assassinated. So Pierre Trudeau, a liberal, the prime minister up there, ordered the Canadian Army into the province of Quebec and shut it down under martial law, and there was a lot of howls about that. Also today, those of you who remember the old black and white TV shows, you asked for it. Not a U.S. for it, the talent show, Arthur Godfrey. He served in the Navy in World War One. I like all these people who serve our country. Then the guy who invented, he started the Jodrell Bank in England, which made England very famous for astronomy, Sir Bernard Lovell, was born today. And then another famous Hollywood person, the writer, the guy who wrote the script for Boys Town, which starred Spencer Tracy and Mickey Rooney. Remember that famous line? He ain't heavy, father. He's my buddy. He's my brother. Excuse me. Dory Sherry, Shary. He was born today. And here's the famous Filipino president after World War II, after the Philippines was finally granted their independence, after the Japanese got their butts kicked out. Raymond Magsaysay. He was assassinated in a plane crash. That's what we think. He died in a plane crash. But like the president of Pakistan 20 years later, Ayub Khan, he also died, general. He also died in a plane crash. And, of course, our sources tell us that there may have been nefarious forces at work behind this thing, behind these assassinations and these mysterious deaths. And talking about death, one of the worst periods in world history occurred in Armenia after World War II, the Turks massacred, it's an estimated 1 million Armenians, forced them out of their lands, and there was rape. Women were set on, stripped and set on fire. Their bellies were cut open. Horrible things. And the Turks to this day, like the Japanese, will not apologize for the Armenian massacre. The ambassador to from the United States to Turkey at the time was Henry Morgenthau Sr., who was later Secretary of the Treasury in FDR's administration, and he chronicled a lot of this. And some of the Armenians came to the United States, people like William Saroyan, the great author who lived in the Central Valley of California. He was born today. And then another great actor, Raymond Basart, great deep voice, and one of my favorite films is he starred in World War II about an episode that's not well publicized. At the nearly the end of the war, the German army, which was not Nazi per se, the upper echelon was Keitel, and people like that. The German soldiers were either captured and they wanted to turncoat, or be trained to go back into Germany and collect information and then cross through the lines and turn that information over to American military intelligence so they could shorten the war. So he starred in a movie on that, and we'll get a clip. We have a lot of clips in our archives on that. And then if you remember the movie Music Man, the big fat guy who would try to dance around, it was going to be funny, play the horn. Buddy Hackett, he was born today. And then another great actor from Nebraska, we had Henry Fonda from Omaha. We have James Coburn, and we also have Johnny Carson, who's more of a showman. He was in the Navy. James Coburn was born today in 1928. And here's a famous newsman, controversial in, throughout his career. Dan Rather was born in 1931. Texas, and he's part Native American, that's what he says. Anyway, I remember the 1968 Chicago Democrat Convention, a Democratic Convention held in Chicago, and where the one night I decided not to do any filming, I was watching, and Walter Cronkite was up in the booths overlooking the Coliseum, and Dan Weather was trying to get an interview or something, and he got knocked down on the ground, and as he went down, he was still holding on to his microphone like a true journalist and talking about the thugs and all that. And Dan Rather, Walter Cronkite said something like, "I can see them up there." And then he later got into a confrontation with Mayor Daley, who said that, and I remember this, and I had seen episodes of this myself when we were down on Lake Michigan, that people like Allen Ginsberg and that were talking about putting LSD in the water. And Richard Daley the First freaked. And, of course, they had had the riots when Martin Luther King died or was assassinated, and the Chicago police were caught, in effect, flat-footed, and they weren't going to get caught flat-footed in the August 1968 Democratic Convention. And also there was the 1968 uprising in Czechoslovakia. There was a lot of action going on, and it was quite an upheaval. And earlier that year, we had in May, the De Gaulle government collapsed, and there were the riots in France. They're always having riots. And he just said, "I've saved France twice in my lifetime. I quit. I retire." We'll get into Charles de Gaulle, who I think is the greatest modern Frenchman. A lot of people who know his background. He's the one who said, when China is going to be a big power in the Far East, and we better pay attention. And also the French have had the second earliest history in what was called the Orient. The first were the Portuguese, and who came with the priests, and then the French came into Indochina, and until they were kicked out after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, where they got their butts kicked. 1952, I think it was. Okay, and then among the other things that happened today, we have Elridge Cleaver, Black Panthers. He got religion and became a Republican. Can you believe that? And then we have the guy who, if you go to Washington and go to the Air Space Museum, Paul Garber was one of the people who started that, and he was born in 1977. Among the deaths, the most interesting death was famous English author who was in prison on and off during the 16th century, John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, which was later turned into an opera by Vaughan Williams. Very beautiful opera. Among the interesting events, talking about English history, Pope Paul II, back in the 15th century, deposed and excommunicated Henry VIII for his divorce of Catherine of Aragon, who was his legitimate queen, and they were married in the Catholic Church. So this is, and so Henry got pissed off and started, set himself up as the head of the Church of England, which is very difficult sometimes to distinguish between their rights and the Roman Catholic Church's rights. They don't use Latin, though they speak English, or they did the last time I visited one of their churches. And then in 1842, the U.S. Navy set up an observatory, and that was the home of the Vice President of the United States for a while, and that was authorized by Congress. And then in 1907, the prelude to World War I was set in place. They had the Triple Entente. This was a treaty between England, France, and Russia. And they were to come to the aid of each other, and the French and the English buried their hatchet not in each other's head. Of course, this was turned, this whole idea of the Triple Entente was supposed to be a military and political bulwark against Germany and Austria-Hungary. And then, this is unfortunate, 1919, the Communist Party of America was set up, and but its birth was in Chicago, of all places. Incidentally, Chicago has been the city which has hosted more presidential campaigns than any other city in American history. In fact, a notorious case that we're still involved in here, involving Terrence Hallinan's father, Patrick Hallinan, another controversial lawyer. He was the Communist Party's presidential candidate in 1952. He was later arrested on some other charge and served prison time in Terminal Island and federal prison in Washington State. But he was nominated along with a black woman, I forgot her name, for vice president, and these were the nominees of the American Communist Party. Also today, we had the Census Bureau was founded in 1954. This is during the Eisenhower administration. And then also in Chicago, the first sun-powered automobile in 1955 was unveiled. I don't know what happened to it. And then in 1957, Malaysia got its independence. Now, Malaysia, there was a lot of guerrilla war with the communists, and the British sent in an anti-terrorism expert. I forgot his name, and American Special Forces people learned from his tactics and tried to apply them in Vietnam. And, of course, Malaysia's got its problems with the Muslims and the Chinese. Also today, in 1978, I do remember that, here in the area at the time, the Sudanese Liberation Army people, the Harris couple, pleaded guilty to the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. And I remember when the FBI captured her, and found out where she was hiding out. And it's also, incidentally, near the house of one of the corrupted jurors, an Iranian lesbian, who was put on the jury in the Stephen Mary kangaroo court case. We'll get into the names of the jurors and what's behind them. It's quite interesting. So that was that for 1978. And then the last thing, I think we got it all today. Now we're going to play the interview that we did with Jack Phillips. And you can also see Jack Phillips. He looks like he's got a beautiful mane and a really great guy. Unfortunately, I didn't take electronic technical training with him, but he taught many of the technicians, broadcast technicians, here in San Francisco and in Northern California at John O'Connell School. And where is Jack? Here is Jack Phillips. It's Jack Kuriak. I'm looking for him. I think he's up here. Oh, sorry. I'm going to have to purge some of this. We have quite a few, several hundred interviews that I've done that are they get mixed up in the board here. And I'm sorry that I'm running this delay a little bit because I'm trying to find the bloody thing. It's a great interview, and it's a lot of information that you won't get from these schools that tell you you can become a broadcaster. Where are you, Jack? Where are you, Jack? We got Jay the Wheeler Jagger. We got Jack Kuriak. Let's see. Oh, I think it's Phillips. Here we go. Here's Jack Phillips.
I mean, just make sure I got the volume here. Oh, you look great, Jack. Let me just make sure I got the volume here.
The TV industry started right after World War II, late 40s. First channel on the air was KPIX.
That's San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Was it owned by CBS?
I don't remember who owned them. I think it might very well have been. It was CBS as far back as I can remember. And they had their transmitter on top of and some studios in the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And a lot of the TV stations staffed them with people that were working for them, the radio stations that they also owned. For instance, CBS had a radio station, and
KCBS, like,
pardon?
KCBS.
KCBS, yeah. Mm-hmm. And NBC had a radio station. Mm-hmm. And
Westinghouse, Channel 7.
Channel 7 was
ABC.
KGO, yeah, mm-hmm. ABC. And their original staff was people that moved into TV from radio because the people that were available, that was it. There wasn't any TV people really available. Particularly on the technical side, TV was a whole new industry. And at that time, the whole world, the whole technical world, required a lot of maintenance because it was all vacuum tubes. And vacuum tubes are like light globes. They have a finite life. They burn out after a few hundred or a couple of thousand hours. And so they needed technical staff. And I had worked as a technician first in the coin machine business and then some other things, and ultimately worked in TV. And KALW was part of the TV training program at the O'Connell School in San Francisco, and it was partially funded by MDTA. That was Manpower Development and Training Act that was federally put together from World War II. And I went to work there in 1966 in the electronics department. And if a student came in that wanted to be an electronic technician, he was almost guaranteed a job because there just weren't enough of those guys. And some of the equipment that the TV stations had at the end of the 50s and in the early 60s was very complex for its day and required a lot of maintenance. A videotape machine was in use in the broadcast trade before we even knew tape for audio existed. And the things were, the machines were very complex and very troublesome.
Jack, the some people prefer vacuum tubes, like the old Macintosh amplifiers and that. Are they superior to the new
no.
development?
The it's a how can I put it?
Choice?
Fetish.
Ah.
Okay. And, you know, they work, and they work well. They're beautiful amplifiers, but you can get a better amplifier today for a lot less money. The interesting thing about it is that most of the distortion in an audio system at the low frequency end is generated by the loudspeakers. Nobody seems to ever talk about it, though.
Mm.
Okay.
So like the subwoofers?
But the that's where the
distortion
the
is.
Low frequency, the woofers and the subwoofers.
Could you offset that with a frequency machine, equalizer?
No. It has to do with the physical size of the parts in a loudspeaker. There's a saying in the trade that says you can't get big sound out of a small box. And for big, low-frequency sound, you need big loudspeakers and big amplifiers. Mm. But anyway, back to the O'Connell School. In the O'Connell School, there was an electronics department, and there were four or five of us on the third floor and on the fifth floor, there was KALW, and one man, Ken Nielsen, and he had been there for a lot of years when I went there, and he was approaching retirement. KALW radio was on the air a few hours a day. There was not the demand for and the desire for and the money for a radio station that there is today. And so KALW first went on the air right after World War II and back in the 50s, late 40s, and it had been in the works for a long time. I don't know how long.
Hmm. What was the first school district owned station west of the Mississippi?
It was the first district owned station. And as I said, was on the air for, they turn it on and run it for a couple hours to train people what to do in a radio station from the technical end, and they also learned a little about how to sit in front of a microphone. In 1970, give or take a couple of years, I'm going to say 69, maybe 70, 71, somewhere in there, the demand for band space, bandwidth, room for another radio station began to increase for FM. It had already been there for AM, and the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, had pretty good control over AM radio, and it was necessary if you were in AM radio. In order to be there, you had to be there, so to speak. And there were a lot of stations that were on the air 24 hours a day. We could run, for training purposes, we could run an FM station and turn it on once a week. Shut it down for the summer vacation. And then the Federal Communications Commissions came in and said that you're going to lose your license because there are people that want it. And so we realized that it was a case of either use it or lose it. And so we had to upgrade KALW from a part-time training school to a full-time, on-the-air, 14, 15 hours a day, maybe 18 hours a day, I don't remember which. And Ken Nielsen, that had been teaching the program, was moved to manager of the radio station. Shortly thereafter, Ted Samuel and Leon Del Grande came in as the program director, and so on and so forth. Ken became the chief engineer, and I took over the training part of it, and that would have been early 1970s. I was there for 20 some odd years before I retired. I don't remember any exact dates, so these dates are loose. At the time I left, the industry was in a big dip. It was entirely different than it was when I first started. I had people calling me from all over the country saying, I understand you have a training program for technicians, and you could put them anywhere they wanted to go. I think there was two or three of them over that time went to work for CBS New York. And at one time, a good portion of the people working in the technical end of the broadcast business were people that I had been involved in the training with. Then in late 70s, that began to change, because the videotape machine that I mentioned earlier had moved up. It was less troublesome. You didn't have to have a technician there to hold its hand all day. Today, videotape is a thing of the past. We have little disc recorders, or in some cases, full solid-state big chips that will store program material. Relatively trouble-free. And where you, if you were a major market station like any of those here in San Francisco during the 60s and early 70s, you had to have a technician on hand 24 hours a day. Today, the vacuum tube is gone. All of the equipment, not all of it, but a large portion of the equipment is throwaway, because where the old videotape machines cost $250,000. The ones today cost $250, $300, $500. And they're throwaways. When it quits working, you throw it out. And that's kind of the way it is. And of course, the need for a training program is gone.
So if a young person was coming to you and they say, Jack, based on your experience, could you give me some advice on should I go into the broadcasting industry? Is it going to be a lifetime job guarantee, or like as some artists say, you better have another job?
Well, I would say in this world, as fast as things are moving, I wouldn't depend upon any job to be a lifetime job. That's the way it is. A lot of people do. And I don't know if I would go into the broadcast business or not. There are bankruptcies occurring, and that was unheard of 30 years ago.
What about these broadcasting schools? Are they? Do you have an opinion on those?
As I said, I don't think the employment opportunities are there.
Maybe.
Well, there's a job pops up every now and then, but it's always for a seasoned technician, somebody. You might have to go out and do something else for a while, get your basic electronics together, and then take what you can get and keep your eyes open. And maybe after a while get something a little more complex, but get your basics together first.
Do you have any views on shortwave radio?
On what?
Shortwave radio.
Oh, communications radio is, like cell phones. There's millions of them. It's a big industry. TV, community TV or cable TV or whatever you want to call it, is important, and it's there. I don't know how they pay.
Very little, I understand, of anything.
Yeah, I would suspect that they're not real big.
Some of it's ego.
Pardon?
Some of it's ego. You get your face on the tube.
Yeah. No, I don't know. If I were a young person just getting out of school, I'd go out and grab what I could get right now. I mean, it's a tough market in any of the fields. I don't expect to become a millionaire overnight. But there always is employment for good electromechanical type persons, people that can get into an electromechanical system and are good screwdriver operators, people that can fix things, tinkerers. These people aren't going to make an awful lot of money, but they always get by. And, I speak from my own experience. I never had to go down to the state office of employment, sign up for unemployment insurance or anything.
Now, some of these schools, I think it's like ITT, you see these ads on TV for technical training. Are they of any value, or are they hustles, or what?
There is some value, but, again, when TV first hit the market, A good TV set was $400.
Oh yeah, very expensive. Small tube, small screen.
Yeah, a little 12-inch screen thing was $400 or $500, and that number stayed there. When color came along, it was still $500, partly because production costs had gone down, and partly because dollar value had gone down. And even today, you can buy a pretty nice TV set for $400 with today's dollar, which is worth a fourth of what it was, or a tenth of what it was.
Now, those TVs, when they broke down, there were all these TV repair shops. Today, what are they making? Just throw away TVs, get another one?
Yeah. Well, you look at it. If it's something that you can replace at a reasonable price, but finding components is difficult for them. And as I said, the days of the vacuum tube where you could just pull one out and stick another one in and it's fixed, that's over with. It's sort of the parallel that I draw is sort of like that of the automobile. In the World War II days and afterward for quite a while, if you lifted the hood of your car up and looked at the engine, you saw an engine and you saw some wires that went to some spark plugs and all that sort of stuff. And a guy that had some mechanical
ability,
affinity, could fix it. You could do it yourself. You can't do car repair yourself anymore.
Yeah, you need a computer and a technician.
you need a technician, and finding parts is difficult.
Yeah.
And expensive. And so the TV business is the same way, at the production of programming area, at the TV station itself, the broadcast facility, and at the TV reception, your TV receiver. All of it has changed dramatically from what it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and it will continue to change.
I will do part two of this interview on Friday, and it's very relevant because there are people who we see a lot of talking heads who don't do research, and as Leo Lee, who used to work in conjunction with KALW and all the other public broadcasting here in San Francisco and Northern California. When I studied at Western Public Radio, we used to always say, keep your leave that S at the door, leave your politics out. And we trained a lot of people, but the money's not there. But, you know, if the dedication and the soul is, pursue it. So we'll end with our usual, and we'll be back Friday at 5 o'clock.
Hey, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
K2.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
Out.
Well, we hope there's no Republican who's going to just throw the campaign away, and we hope maybe we'll get somebody who's for everybody, for people, and not for vested interests, the bogus nonprofits, the illegal aliens, the crotch politics agenda. This is Peter Paul Brizola. We'll be back Friday and continue with the Jack Phillips wisdom, 50 years of it, in the broadcasting field. Good night. We're ending.